Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner right here on your home for the 2016 mayoral debate, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And that debate takes place at 7 o'clock and at the right here in the Murphy Auditorium on Morgan State University's campus on Thursday night. Join us there and be part of that discussion. It's going to be one of the most important debates and conversations for this mayor's race you will find. Before we get to our conversation today about this presidential race and the very strange intersections of race and class and the intensity of all of that, I remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to testing, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org, or at SteinerShow.org is the Maryland State Education Association's banner. We are joined now for this conversation by Dr. Lester Spence, Center for Emerging Media Scholar in Residence, Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University, author of Knocking the Hustle, Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics, and Edward Wyckoff Williams, television producer, correspondent, and writer living in New York City, both long-standing guests here on the show. Welcome, men. Gentlemen, it's good to have you both with us.
A pleasure to be with you, Mark.
And you all can join us here with your thoughts and comments at 410-319-8888. Tweet us at Mark Steiner, comment on the Mark Steiner Show Facebook page, or send us an email to talk@steinershow.org. There's so many places we could start this conversation, but I you know, when I look at, when I was looking at the results coming in these primaries, it was really glaring to me that in the most Republican conservative states, in the former Confederate states, you saw Trump running away with most of the Republican vote, most of the white Republican vote running away with that in those states, and Hillary Clinton running away with the African-American vote. And it to me, it just rang about true about how the complexities of race and class show themselves in this election. I want to start at that point. I have other points to make on that, but let's let me begin with you. I mean, this is, to me, this is a more glaring, I think, than it has been in past elections.
Well, first, I'll say this. It's not so much race, class, but also race, class, and gender. Second, it's not Hillary. Technically, she won the black vote, but it wasn't a runaway. There are segments of the black vote that Bernie Sanders won. So I think what we're looking at now is the first time in several elections where not only is the black vote something people fight for, but it's actually contested, right? So you actually have black folk talking within black communities about whether they're for Clinton or for Sanders. And then you actually have both candidates actively fighting for the black vote, using very, very different kind of campaign strategies. It's complicated, but I'll just say it's cool to see, even as we have the threat of somebody like Trump looming over our heads.
I want to get back to the cool to see part in just a second, because I find that interesting. But Edward, why don't you jump in first?
One of the things that struck me most about the way that Hillary Clinton won in South Carolina is that she did so, but with far fewer voters than came out in 2008 for Barack Obama.
Yes.
And so I think that's where Democrats need to be concerned. The African-American vote isn't being galvanized. Now, a part of that is there isn't a black man with a beautiful black wife and two black children at the helm of this party driving this election. The truth of the matter is, and this is something that people don't talk about because it almost seems sort of like trite, is that white people in America have been voting for white politicians since the founding of this nation. It took Barack Obama to help black people see, finally, someone that looked like them that could actually win the office. And so that just naturally galvanizes beyond the actual politics. I think that there are lots of black people who actually voted for him who possibly did not necessarily agree with his politics. They were just emotional and galvanized and felt very positive about the fact that he could actually do it. That's not the case here. And this is something that you, Mark, and I have talked about, and something that I was worried about even in 2013, leading up to this election, that the Democratic Party has at its helm four old white people: Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid, and now Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. And there is nothing wrong with that. These are people who have a long history of supporting issues that matter to African Americans, but it is not reflective of the body politic, which is browner and which is blacker and which is far more progressive. And these are people who have been in power for a long time, deeply entrenched power, and a part of how all this plays out and a part of why you're having the conversation you're having today is because now we need to galvanize the black vote in order to beat someone like Trump.
So I'm going to come to this question of galvanizing the black vote and what might happen in this general election and how I think it speaks to the deep divide in this country. But what you just said earlier, Lester, let me just kind of push back a little bit. I mean, and see what you meant by what you said. Looking at the primary vote so far, Hillary won 87% of the black vote in South Carolina. She won 93% of the black vote in Alabama. She won 90% of the black vote in Arkansas. 80% of the vote in Tennessee, I mean to say. I mean, and state after state. I mean, so it's not a small percentage we're talking about. It's a huge percentage, especially in the South, but also it seems to be playing itself out in Michigan, your home state.
So I was looking at a different set of numbers, and I was also looking at kind of the overlap with other different demographics, right? So, I want to talk about what I said, but I also kind of want to push back on the other brother on the show.
Let me jump in for a second because something's wrong with the Skype. We're losing every other word. So I really want to hear your response to this. So, Mark Henry's giving you a call on the phone right now. Is that cool?
Yeah, cool.
So yeah, because we're quite losing that. While we're waiting, folks, join us here 410-319-8888. We want to hear your thoughts on this. But I think what I was going to ask Lester when he comes back as well, Edward. I think there's been other studies out that I've been looking at that show. There's a difference between white and black Democratic voters, mm-hmm. and that some white voters, the majority of white voters, are further to the left than some black voters.
Yeah, they are. And I think particularly in places like the South. So it's not surprising. I spoke to a really dear friend of mine who's actually from South Carolina before the South Carolina primary, and she was convinced 100%. She's actually from Columbia, South Carolina.
Right.
She was convinced that African-American voters would not be voting for Bernie. And she said it's partly because a lot of those people are evangelicals. The South, no matter what you want to say about it, blacks and whites actually from the South have far more in common than they have different. And I think it played out that way. They are traditionalists down there. And a part of why Hillary is winning in the South is because they've stuck with their traditions. You know, they know the Clintons. That's an entity that is understood by them. Bernie is new. He's from the Northeast, and those liberal, far progressive politics don't necessarily resonate in those places. And I think it does this country a disservice when it comes to our politics. But we have to understand the politics of the day and the politics of our history.
But Lester, welcome back on the phone here. So I was asking about giving all those numbers I saw and before it went on the air and talking about your home state of Michigan as well. What were you going to say?
Yeah, I was going to say I try really hard not to talk about the black vote. I don't think there is a black vote. They're black voters.
I agree.
Really important empirically and politically to not talk about the black vote as if we're all the same because we're not.
Right.
And I know the other brother recognizes this, but it's important to say that out loud. Right. Mm-hmm. Second, I think I think he's right where black voters where I talk about black voters, there is a significant segment of black voters who are moderate to conservative. Right. We're all anti-racist. Right. That's the one thing you can say you can agree. We're all pretty much anti-racist, but some of us believe that the economy should be rearranged. Some of us think the economy is okay. I think that Clinton is going to do better with moderate to conservative voters, first of all. But second, there's an institutional apparatus that she has, and this goes back to another critique I'd have. Black voters didn't naturally vote for Obama. Black voters were mobilized by an institutional infrastructure that Obama created to take advantage of young voters and black voters. That institutional apparatus, Hillary Clinton has the closest thing to that. Bernie Sanders doesn't. And that's another reason why he's why the segment of black voters he is most likely to get support from aren't turning out for him, because he's not able to mobilize them effectively.
One of the things I just, again, obviously, what you made me think of, Lester, is that in 2008, when Barack Obama was first running in the primaries before he won Iowa, most of the polling showed that the majority of black support was not going to Barack Obama until he won Iowa.
Yes.
Right?
That's right.
And that goes to show how deeply entrenched the political apparatus that my colleague just spoke about is effective, particularly when it comes to the Clintons. The Clintons' brand is extremely strong, and I think people don't understand that. They think that, really, and I hate to say this because it seems slightly misogynistic or disrespectful of Hillary, but Bill Clinton is also winning in this election. There's a lot of people who are going to the polls voting for Hillary because of him. And so I don't think that we should discredit that nor ignore it. And I think that Bernie, one, started late. He's a man of ideas, and that's beautiful. And I would love to see those ideas and ideals triumph. But there is an institution here. There is an apparatus here that's been in place for a very long time. And beyond that, what Barack Obama did was he used analytics. He created a whole new platform for how to run an election. He used social media platforms that had never been used in elections before. Hillary Clinton is using some of the same people who put that apparatus into place, and she's capitalizing off of it, and there is nothing wrong with that, because I'd rather much see her in the White House than Trump or Cruz or Rubio. But that is what's happening here, and it's why Bernie Sanders is struggling.
Let me invite for a few minutes here in part of this conversation, so I want to turn to how Black Lives Matter and families are being dragged into this campaign. We saw earlier today, I think you sent it to me, Edward, you just sent it to me, that the mothers of Trayvon Martin and Jordan Davis came out for Hillary Clinton and denounced Sanders' ties to the NRA, which I thought was kind of a very specious ad, but you know, whether you're for Sanders or not.
Yeah.
But then you also saw Erica Garner, who is the daughter of Eric Garner, in this very poignant, moving TV ad for Bernie Sanders, which I found interesting. And so I want to bring this into the conversation for a few minutes here, who joined us because of Edward, Natalie Jackson, who is a racial justice activist and civil rights lawyer who represented Trayvon Martin's family alongside of Benjamin Crump. The conversation as we open the phones. And Natalie, welcome. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me.
And I know you came out for Bernie Sanders, if I have that correct. So I'd like to wrestle with that and let you start off and go to Lester and over to Edward just for a few minutes here to talk a bit about this battle over the vote surrounding the Black Lives Matter movement, surrounding this the explosive growth in consciousness because of the videos about in the larger part of America, the killings of young black Americans, and how that's playing into this campaign. Natalie, then I'm going to Lester. I'm curious about your response to this, Lester. Natalie?
Well, I think what this has shown us is that the Black Lives Matter activists have really put the issue of black lives and police violence and gun violence on the national platform and on the national stage. So kudos to them, because this is a battle over the black vote between, especially for the Democrats, between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. And I think that they recognize that the young black activists who are in the Black Lives Matter movement, they represent the black vote, black vote that's up for contention and up to be battled over.
Yeah, Lester, give me your analysis of that. You've been following it. I mean, you've been doing a lot on your Facebook page around all of this, and this whole question of class and race, which will come to it after the break. But talk a bit about what Natalie was saying and this the kind of tugging here of who's going to support who in this battle and how the Black Lives Matter is playing into this.
Yeah, I think that, first of all, I think she's right. Black Lives Matter has done more to kind of bring police violence to light than any movement that I'm familiar of over my adult lifetime and probably over my lifetime period since 69, right? And this, how this plays out in this election is, again, black voters are incredibly important to the Democratic Democratic constituencies. So Sanders and Clinton are both fighting hard for them, right? And they're they're fighting hard for them in part because the work that activists have done in cities bring to light police brutality, but also because the activists have actually been pushing both Clinton and Sanders to kind of recognize what they're doing. So that's a wonderful thing. What you see with the different ad campaigns, because you have some folks supporting Sanders and some folk supporting Clinton, again, it's kind of black politics at work. You've got people who are Black Lives Matter activists or people who've been victimized by police violence directly who support Clinton for a number of important reasons, and then you've got people who support Sanders for pretty important reasons. I actually believe that this type of dynamic is really, really healthy for black communities. And I have to say, just for the record, that I plan on voting for Sanders in the primary. So it's not like I don't have a dog in the hunt. I do. But I think that this is all it's a really, really good look. The challenge, though, is as the brother on the other call mentioned, is that our turnout is low. Right. And again, this is because actually neither Clinton nor Sanders has the apparatus Obama did, although Clinton comes closer.
Mm-hmm. Right. And just to add on to that, Edward, I would say that we're also seeing in the black community, the black political community, a sort of battle between the old guard and the new guard, the Black Lives Matter activists, and a battle for their hearts and their votes.
Right. And so what moved you to move for Sanders, Natalie, but while we have you here on the phone?
His economic justice platform has been the primary reason that I've supported him from the beginning. It's because I understand the racial justice platform, but one thing that I think coincides with both communities, the white community and the people of color community, is the commonality of poverty. So I think that that's something where we can all work together and achieve something in overcoming poverty. And so what Bernie Sanders talks about when he talks about economic justice, it really struck a chord with me.
Though I would say, Edward, Bernie Sanders did get in trouble over his ghetto remarks.
Yes, he did. And you know what that shows, Mark? It's back to what you and I almost predicted 2 years ago, is that when you have these kinds of candidates who are that old and white and have experienced white privilege in the ways that they have, at no fault of their own, but as a result of the system in which we all live, they then echo the kinds of ideologies that are out of touch with our present socio-political reality. And this is the problem with both Hillary and Sanders, even though I think, if anything, Sanders is the best option. A part of my problem with Hillary is that she knows what to say in order to get elected in a very old-school Democratic Party toting the line kind of way. But I am unconvinced that the crime bill, like when they talked about this in the debate in Flint, Michigan, that the crime bill that she supported in 1994 that her husband put forward isn't the kind of policies that she too would kowtow to if she were up against a very staunch Republican-held Congress. Like, these are people who make compromises. They don't stand strong, and they certainly don't stand strong on issues that really matter to African-American communities. They are happy to go to churches and stand next to bishops in the Church of God in Christ and get black people to come out for them on a Sunday. But at the end of the day, they make behind-the-door deals. And at least Bernie Sanders, it's very clear, whether or not he's informed or not, is a man of principle.
Right, and I agree with that, and I think one of the things that we saw Bernie Sanders' campaign do very early on was during the Black Lives Matter protest when they were interrupting the candidates. We saw Bernie Sanders take the next day actually hire one of the Black Lives Matter protest activists, Simone Sanders, as his national director. So I think that Bernie Sanders is saying, listen, I know where my shortcomings are when I'm talking about black issues, but I'm willing to work and try to figure out and find people who can help me understand these issues. And I think that's very impressive for him. And once again, you know, I agree totally with Edward that both of these candidates, you know, they're not, they're older white liberals who have been steeped in white privilege. So they're not going to understand what we understand. So comments like the ghetto comments, I don't know if we should really dwell on that. I think what we should dwell on is what we have in a commonality as a nation, as Americans. And the commonality that all people in America have is poverty. And that's the platform that Bernie Sanders is running on. And I think that's the platform that we actually can have change in America on.
Lester?
Yeah, I think I've got a dog in this hunt. I think I agree with her totally. I think that what Sanders has to do is, and actually I'd extend this to talk about whites as well. What Sanders has to do, if you think about, there is a quote unquote natural constituency among black voters that Sanders can get support from. There's a quote-unquote natural constituency amongst white voters that Sanders can get support from, but it's really on him to develop the type of really grassroots or organizations that can reach out to those folk in language that they're familiar with and to get them not only to the polls but to support another political project going forward. Because that's really the question. Like, how do we do that, right? We're talking about Clinton versus Sanders, and then one of them versus Trump. But what we should really be talking about is how we create a country where the policies that support the policies that can deal with economic violence can be promoted and turned into legislation.
And there is this, always has been, so I want to explore after break, this kind of, and you've been writing and talking about this a lot, Lester, in your book, in your latest book, The Knock and the Hustle, to this conversations I've seen and been part of a little bit on Facebook that you've been having, this whole very strange intersection between race and class in America, the dynamic here, and the looking at why so many white folks are flocking to the Republican Party and to Donald Trump, at the same time why there has been a lack of move to the left in many ways on the parts of the black community, which is different than it was in America 40 years ago during the height of the civil rights movement. So there's an interesting dynamic happening here that I think we've yet to define about what it means for American politics. So I really want to explore that after the break coming up, and so we can kind of really wrestle. A number of our callers are calling in. I think I want to wrestle with that too for that last part of our show. So we're going to take a quick break here. Natalie Jackson, we look forward to having you back. Thank you so much for being part of the show. I wanted to hear your thoughts. Racial justice activist and civil rights attorney who represented Trayvon Martin's family alongside Ben Crump. We'll come back with Lester Spence and Ed Wyckoff-Williams and you at 410-319-8888 to explore where this all fits. And we'll start with Lester Spence and go to Fred and Clarence and Ernest who are holding on. You're going to get on the air. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Continue our conversation here on A Way to Our Conversation. Reminding you, Thursday, March the 10th, just a couple days from now, 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Murphy Fine Arts Center, is the Ask, Listen, Vote, Solutions and Strategies for the Future mayoral debate taking place here. It will be aired live on WEAA. We have our moderators and candidates here. You can talk to them via Twitter, hashtag Baltimore Debates. Go to WEAA.org for more information. Or reserve your seat now at baltimoremayoraldebate.eventbrite.com. Or show on up and see if you can find a seat. This Thursday night, 7 p.m., Murphy Auditorium, here on Morgan State University's campus, for a real rip-roaring mayoral debate. We're here with Edward Wyckoff-Williams, television producer, correspondent, and writer living in New York City, Dr. Lester Spence, Center for Emerging Media Scholar in Residence, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University, author of Knocking the Hustle Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics, and you all are 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org for an email. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Lester, you heard what I posited before we went to break. So I think this is about the black vote in America not necessarily moving to the left as it did in the 60s and in the 70s and even earlier when black folks in the North could vote in the 30s.
Yeah, and while I think that the Black Lives Matter, that type of that activism has the potential to move black voters to the left, As it stands right now, white voter, black voters ideologically have stayed the same, have moved a little bit to the right, while white voters have moved to the left, particularly on economic issues. And that's largely because the institutions that were responsible for kind of socializing black folk ideologically have either themselves become increasingly conservative, here the black churches stand out, or they're no longer present the way they used to be. And here unions stand out, right? Mm-hmm. So we've got a lot of work to do. To the extent I've been talking about Black Lives Matter and the challenges it faces going forward, the questions they face is how do they create the institutional base to kind of reorient black people to the point where if they wouldn't necessarily support Sanders in the primary, they'll at least support and articulate his policies or policies that are on his side of the ideological spectrum.
I completely agree with Lester.
Interesting.
And I want to add this. There are two words that I think are that can help us understand what's happening in this election. They are complacency and apathy. A part of how Republicans have won, not just over this election cycle in terms of galvanizing more voters to the polls, but also over the last 8 years, is by crippling President Barack Obama's presidency. This was a man who would have been a Bernie Sanders in his own time had he been allowed to be. I think he would have done far more on poverty and criminal justice had he actually been able to govern. All he was able to really do is change a few rules around crack cocaine via the Justice Department and investigate more police brutality, and then obviously Obamacare, which itself has been crippled by the Supreme Court decision, which basically made the Medicaid rule something that could be decided by the states. So back to states' rights and African Americans being dictated to by whatever individual state that they were in. And so I think had we had 8 years of progressive politics, and not just progressive talk, because Barack Obama and his administration has been great at articulating what we need to do on education, what we need to do on poverty, what we need to do on jobs. But it's not been able to do anything because a president is not a dictator. He needs a Congress to work with him. And to that end, African Americans, I believe, are apathetic about what is even possible. And to that end, if they are looking at a black president who couldn't get anything done, why should they get off the couch? As Barack Obama said, call your cousin Pookie and get him to the polls. Why should Pookie get off the couch if he knows that Republicans in Congress won't do anything?
Go ahead, Lisha.
It's not like that. That's not why black. First of all, most of the folks in the Democratic primary were black, right? Now, yes, the turnout has been lower, but rather than kind of giving a cultural story, I tend to focus on institutions, right? If we don't have the institutions that kind of are designed to kind of keep people mobilized, that keep people active, then you're going to actually have low turnout. In fact, and it's worth talking about what Obama's biggest mistake. I talked about institutional infrastructure. That institution had a name. I think it was called something like Organizing for America or something.
Yeah.
It's the entity that he created that he used to raise money to get people who weren't involved in politics to get involved, to get those people to mobilize votes, to register votes, and in some cases to get people to run for office. One of the first decisions he made was he killed it. Right. Now, if you take that narrative versus the cultural dysfunction narrative, right, what you have is an elitist story about how black folk are consistently mobilized only for one activity, voting an elite into office. And then after that, they're consistently demobilized. Right. So as we're talking about the role race, class and gender, and we haven't really gotten to gender yet, plays in this election. It's really important to have that conversation. But again, my bigger concern is how we keep black folk active engage to the point where they're, and then how do we turn them ideologically? That story is, the story I'm telling is not a story of cultural dysfunction. It's not a story about Pookie and Ray Ray staying home. They actually outvote consistently more than their similarly situated white counterparts.
As much as I agree with that, I'm not even just talking about black liberals who are disengaged now.
Yeah.
I'm talking about gays as well. I'm talking about women. I think particularly young women and young people in general. And I think that is a part of the apathetic story that we have been sold by the Republican Party over the last 8 years, which has been highly effective.
Got you. I got you. I think so. What I would point to, so we're talking about the same phenomenon. I just have a kind of an elitist approach to that, right? Because I look
I understand.
So the other way to think about that is, particularly in cities like Baltimore, in Detroit, right? Those Democratic elites are running in elections where it's only Democrats voting, and what they want turnout low as well. Right. So maybe to cut the middle between our two points, it's like a combination of Republican and Democrat party elites basically making making moves to demobilize voters.
Yeah.
And then nothing we do from the bottom up gives the populations we care about something, a vehicle to hold on to keep engaging in politics, even as everybody's telling them they shouldn't be engaged.
Let me talk about engaging people. Let's engage on our listeners here and get them on the air with us at 410-319-8888. Let's go to Fred on line two. You're on the air. Welcome, Fred. Sorry to keep you waiting.
No problem. Great conversation. You guys have a great debate going on.
Thank you.
You can still have me on hold for what I thought I had to contribute. But, you know, I look at this I agree with Lester about Bernie. Your position about Bernie Sanders, Lester, I believe I agree with you on that. But to be honest and truthfully, I'm a Republican myself. I've been a registered Republican for 46 years. I've never understood why the black community is so just religiously go behind the Democratic Party, and especially about someone like Hillary Clinton. I know that, you know, everyone has their feelings about her, but the two things that she's done that I couldn't appreciate, if I may say. One was telling people that she got off a plane and went into Bosnia under fire. I think, you know, either something's wrong with her or something's wrong with the electorate to even, you know, put her in this position that she's in now. And the second thing she did I didn't appreciate was the families of the people who were killed in Benghazi. She told those people that their family was killed because of the video and they were going to arrest the guy that did it. She told them that in Dover. And the people came out and said that she said that. And when a reporter asked her, did she say that, she said no. So he asked her, well, the father, daughter, brother, mother, whatever, said that you said that. So he said, well, somebody's lying, aren't they? And she said, they are. Now, I got a feeling when they bring all that play to the table, she shouldn't be able to win an election in November. But then on top of it, when you add this security scenario about these emails, now I know that people say, oh, well, that's just one of those things. But just like they say, people have done far less than what she did with those emails, and they lost their clearances.
Well, let me have a quick comment on this. And Fred, as Republican, who are you voting for? I'm curious.
Yeah.
No. Right, okay.
Did you answer?
No.
Okay.
Go ahead, Edward.
Mark, I hate to sound a little mean or elitist in that way, as Lester said, but a part of what we hear when we hear callers like that is a lack of information and education. These are people who are uninformed and who are manipulated by Fox News-style propaganda. This whole Benghazi thing and the email thing has been a part of the tooling and engineering of the RNC in order to convince people to be, back to my point, apathetic and complacent. These are lies and innuendo. It's like, where's Barack Obama's birth certificate? But nobody's asking how Ted Cruz is able to run for president when we know he was born in Canada. These are race-laced politics, but they are bigger than that. Because if you get that much propaganda and innuendo, what you end up with is a confused electorate. And that's what we're dealing with. Even African Americans are questioning, what's the deal with Hillary's emails? Why are we focused on emails? Like, this is, it makes no sense, and it angers me, because they are, they might win a battle, but they will always lose the war for lack of education.
Let's go back to the phone, unless you have something you don't weigh in on here.
No. Get some of the callers in.
410-319-8888 is number. Let's go to John. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello, Mark.
Good morning.
I just want to say, first of all, that this program is really a breath of fresh air.
Thank you.
Some of the things are being mentioned I haven't heard brought up before, and I've been thinking them. And what strikes me is all these callers on shows like this on C-SPAN, black and white, male, female, who say, I'm going to either vote for Bernie or vote for Donald Trump. And they're very alienated about Hillary. They're very alienated about the other Republican candidates. And the Republican Party, for instance, it seems like they're losing the whites they used to depend on, not because of racism or something, but because it's simply, you know, their conservative agenda has no relevance to people's lives today. And all you hear Ryan and the other ones talking about is the conservative movement, the conservative movement. And I think the conservative movement that began in 1964 with Reagan and Goldwater is basically dead. That's what's dead, not the Republican Party. And that's all I have to say, basically.
Thank you. Lester?
Yeah, I think, if you look at, I saw the Republican debate for the first time, basically because Carla, you know, asked me to, so I could be, for Democracy.
Oh, you did Democracy Now!
It was like pulling teeth. I hated it. But the one thing that was really clear was that Trump is reaching out to that white voter who's, you know, if he or she has a job, that job's wage, you know, the wages are stagnant, and they, you know, whether, even though productivity is really, really high, and it's clear that that's the vote that should be going to Bernie Sanders, right? But for a number of historical reasons, bipartisan reasons, party-wise, that vote isn't going to Bernie Sanders. That voter isn't even aware somebody like Bernie exists. That's why I've been really focusing on in this conversation and others, the role institutions play. We can't, black folk like me on the left who live in the cities, we simply can't do the work to get people in rural Maryland to vote, you know, for a liberal, much less the left-leaning candidate. Somebody has to take responsibility for that. And then somebody has to take responsibility similarly, because the Democratic Party apparatus won't do it, to organize communities in places like Detroit and Baltimore.
You know, but it's interesting to watch this take place. And there have been a couple of really interesting articles that have been put out recently. Washington Post had a fascinating piece by Max Ehrenfreund on March the 3rd called Researchers Found Strong Evidence That Racism Helps the Grenell Party Win. And what he found basically was in this one study was that conservatives who also have deep negative feelings about the black world, and which is the majority of people, majority of people voting in the Republican primary, are voting Republican, not Democrat. That many conservatives used to vote Democrat who did not have those strong feelings, but they've moved away and gone to the Republican Party as well. So I mean, there's that, and also that part of it is in this New York Times piece where there's this interesting quote and as much as I dislike this guy, Rush Limbaugh predicted, the Trumpists are out there, are going to feel like the establishment is trying to manipulate them, sucker them, and they're just going to dig in deeper. And a Republican, yes. And a Republican voter in California is quoted as saying, the Republican electorate is not a bunch of complete ignorant fools. We know who Donald Trump is, and we're going to use Donald Trump to either take over the Grand Ole Party or blow it up. There's a movement afoot out there.
You know what? It what's so sad? You're right, Mark. Is that? I would never, under any circumstances, agree with Rush Limbaugh, but you are absolutely right. He's right about those voters. What I question is whether or not those voters actually know who Donald Trump is. I'm not sure if any of us fully know who Donald Trump is at the moment. And so that's what I'm worried about. At first, I thought he was a plant by Democrats to help them win this election by showing how outrageous the points of view were of the quote-unquote establishment Republican Party, which has gone so far to the left in its attempts to defeat Obama and undermine Obama's administration that they've basically become clowns and jokers, you know? Sort of like that SNL skit where they have the fake Hillary standing there saying, I've got jokers to the, or clowns to the left of me and jokers to the right, and you're stuck here in the middle with me. The problem is, I think Americans might not be clear on who the clowns and the jokers are. And to that end, that is a part of why Trump is winning. I don't know if they know how dangerous this sort of reality TV politics is. Because they've been seduced by Kim Kardashian and this new world we live in where celebrity trumps both power and politics, and wealth trumps them all.
Let me try to get a couple of callers here in a row, unless you want to jump in on that real fast before I go to the phones.
Well, we're in trouble.
We are.
We really are. I mean, we are
because
not.
Money wins, right, yeah. Lester? Money wins no matter what.
Yeah, we've got a lot. Now, yeah, well, money wins. Money wins, particularly when butts aren't in, you know, when butts aren't put in action, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, and I think that we're. I keep saying over and over again, I haven't written this up, but I'm going to, which is that this election of 2016, to me, is akin to 1860. When there was a four-way race that Lincoln won with a minority of the votes. The divisions, we're seeing for numerous reasons over the last 40 years, especially the last 15, that America's coming apart at the political seams. And I think that's why both from my political perspective, people like Trump and Cruz are scary, and why we're stuck with people like Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
Let me go 410-319-8888. Amanda, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi.
Good morning.
Hi. I am so sick of hearing excuses about the Obama presidency. I don't. You know, I'm a Democrat, mm-hmm. but I never drank the Obama Kool-Aid. Obama, yes, is being undermined by the Republican establishment, but they had a lot of help from Obama himself. You talk about apathy. Obama is the one who's been apathetic. He won't stand up. He won't fight. He definitely won't fight for us. And he could have done a lot, especially when he was first elected. He had the Democrat. He had the Democratic Congress. He had the Democratic Senate. And he could have stopped this bailout. He could have stood by Main Street instead of Wall Street, but he chose to stood with the elite. So, and that hurt African Americans because most of our wealth was in our homes. And so, you know, so Obama has a role in this, in his foreign policy and everything else. So I'm very, very sick of people giving Obama excuses because of the opposition that he's had.
Amanda, I'm glad I turned to your call because I was listening to what you said earlier, Edward, and I was going to say what Amanda said but didn't say it. And I'm so glad you raised this issue. I mean, the Obama presidency is a complex presidency.
Mm-hmm.
A, because he's the first black president, and B, that's a very emotional thing for a lot of us on the planet, for some of us here, right? On the other hand, you know, there's a strong argument made that part of the problem we're facing today and part of the apathy you're seeing among black voters is not just because of two older white people running or young voters not being as excited as they were there, even though they're coming out for Sanders, are coming out in smaller numbers and all the other constituent groups. It's because those years when Obama had the White House and both houses of Congress, he didn't go fight for Main Street. But he could have done a lot more in those first 2 years. And some people, and I might be one of them, who might lay part of the blame for losing both houses to Republicans at his doorstep.
And
because he didn't fight.
And I know that's how you felt. And I mean, we've been talking about this for the last 5 years at least.
Right.
And I know that's how you felt. And I appreciate that. And as much as I disagree with the caller, I can't say that that is an uninformed opinion. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And to that end, what I will say is this, and I am often in this position where I'm quote-unquote defending Obama, but when you talk about the bailout, which is the first thing that she mentioned, she failed to mention Obamacare, which he actually did get through. But when you talk about the bailout, the truth of the matter is, far more African Americans would have been on the streets without their homes had he not negotiated that deal. He stopped the bleeding. There was a major artery that had been punctured, and he stopped the bleeding. And he, like Lester has been talking about, quote-unquote, these institutions, I think it's important for people to understand that he was operating within the institutions that not just only exist, but are extremely powerful. And he had to come up with the best solution. I think Obamacare, as much as it was a compromise, we never got, you know, the single payer solution, which is a very socialist democratic thing in Europe, which would have been better for this country. We didn't get that. Why? Because the Obamacare based on Romney Care worked within the institutions that not just rule in this country, but control our politics. And to that end, yes, like you said, Mark, Obama's presidency has a myriad number of issues that can be debated and all that. But the truth of the matter is, I would rather have that man in office than anything that the Republican Party is offering now. And to that end, I'd rather have Bernie or Hillary than anything the Republican Party is offering now.
Dr. Lester Spence.
Yeah, I agree with that last part. I just, again, go to the – so it's kind of hard to – until more data – and we might not even get the data, but it's kind of hard to figure out what his decision tree was when he was making it, right? Because it's possible, for example, that he wanted to do far much more than what he did, but he had to be constrained. It's possible, on the other hand, though, that he did about what he wanted to do, and he didn't, and, you know, he didn't want to go further than that. What we can say, though, is that in the absence of an institution to push him from the left, he made the decision he made. That we can say with far more accuracy, we could say that it's highly likely he would have done more for black voters and for working class voters had there been an institution that could have pushed him hard from the left.
And you know what, Lester? What's so sad about that truth that you just spoke is the institution that should have done that is the Democratic Party. But we've got a Democratic Party and have had for so long that is beholden to Southern and Midwestern politics.
Yeah.
These are people who want to stay in positions of power, and they are willing to kowtow to the left, to the right within the Democratic Party, and to that end don't stand for the people whose voices are very loud but silenced on the left.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what's happening here. And that's why Bernie is burning at the moment, because people have been dying to hear somebody on the left who's that loud, that dedicated, that passionate.
Yeah.
Let me go back to the phones here. We have just a few minutes left. Got a couple quick calls. Let's go to Clarence. Very quick thought, Clarence.
Yes. I'd like to push back a little bit. In reference to the email service, I want to take you back to what President Kennedy said about secrecy in an open society. Secrecy and secret organizations are repugnant in a free, open society. If there was nothing on those servers and those emails that was illegal, that showed you complicit in any type of criminal activity or destabilizing regimes in the Middle East or anything of that nature, we should know. Okay? So it's not being uninformed. You're telling me I need to make a decision about a person when she's operating in I'm not sure if nefarious is the right word, but secrecy. You don't get that. It is repugnant to operate for a public official to operate in that manner. Thank you.
So I hear what Clarence saying very quickly, because we only have a couple minutes left. Edwin Lesher, one of the things I've been reading though about these emails is that one article people keep forgetting is every Secretary of State before her has come out and been shown to have done the same thing. You know what I'm saying? So maybe they should be. We should have transparency, but this is not a unique situation.
It's not a unique situation, and I really don't want to defend her emails. It would be different if we had found something in her emails that showed that she was treasonous. Then we would be having a real debate. The fact that she used her BlackBerry that was personal, for work purposes, it probably put the country at risk in that we've got, you know, a world full of hackers, particularly in China, who would love to see, and Russia, that would love to see the U.S. embarrassed in those ways. And so to that end, I think it's a legitimate thing to be talking about. But the fact that this is a woman with a stellar record when it comes to her State Department work, I think that I'm worried that Fox News is winning, Mark. That ultimately, and I really don't have much to say to that point about that, because Fox News is winning when you have African Americans calling your show, talking about that. They've all drank the Kool-Aid and they believe that she's dangerous. And I don't know what to say to that. I genuinely don't know what to say to that.
Lester, we have a couple minutes left, so
I disagree, but I agree fully. That's it.
That's it.
Yeah, that's it. I got to teach class at 1:30.
Okay. Oh, and by the way, I'm looking forward to this new history professor that Hopkins just brought in. I saw that on your Facebook, by the way.
Oh, yeah. You know what? I want to give a shout-out to the listeners.
That.
Yo, I'm going to be – I normally don't do this. I'm going to be in debate with Glenn Lowry, a black economist, prominent black economist, about Black Lives Matter and Black America. Tomorrow here at Hopkins is free, 4:30 p.m., Great Hall, Levering Hall. If y'all around, fall through.
That should be interesting.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it should be really interesting. I'm just hoping.
You and Lester for CNN and PBS NewsHour. You guys are amazing.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you. This has been great to have the two of you on. Thank you all for calling in and writing in and being part of this program. Ed Wyckoff-Williams, television producer, correspondent, writer living in New York City. Dr. Lester Spence, author of Knocking the Hustle Against the Neoliberal Turn on Black Politics and associate professor of political science and Africana studies at Johns Hopkins University. Thank you both so much for being with us today. I appreciate it deeply.
Great conversation. Y'all
thank
be cool.
Thank you, guys.
Talk to y'all soon. And thank you all, really, for being part of the show today. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineers, Andre Melton. Our interns are Sianna Greaves, Morgan Barber, who's here today, Manifa Wilson, and Calvin Perry. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program, too. talk@steinershow.org. The podcast, The Mark Steiner Show, and share it with your friends. Visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for the home of the 2016 mayoral debate, which is taking place Thursday night at 7:30 at Murphy Auditorium here on Morgan State University's campus, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.